Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. And welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Elise Arden, author of The Casket Girls and The Romeo Catchers. We'll also hear from Joshua Jelly Shapiro, author of Island People, The World and the Caribbean. Elise Arden is one of New Orleans' great literary success stories. She's a New Orleans native who grew up in the milieu of the Quarter, attended the University of New Orleans and received a degree in theater, then moved to New York for a career in advertising. She began her first novel while studying at the Gotham Writers Workshop and took the unusual course of publishing it chapter by chapter as a serial on Wattpad. Then self-publishing what became The Casket Girls, a vampire and witch-filled story aimed at the young adult market. Then Amazon came calling and offered her a two-book deal with their Skyscape imprint, reissuing The Casket Girls in a new edited edition. And this week, Elise celebrates the publication of her second novel in the series, the evocatively titled The Romeo Catchers. Elise Arden, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And congratulations. You've certainly taken your own path, girl.
Yeah, I feel like that's the New Orleanian in me.
Now, one of the things that fascinates me is that you're really an example of what technology can do for writing. So talk a bit about that initial experience writing and posting on Wattpad, because your readers really kept you going, didn't they?
Sure. When I started writing, it was a very unusual path. I was new to writing fiction, and it was a New Year's resolution for me. So I took a workshop and was really trying to do new things. So I didn't know a ton about fantasy, but I grew up in New Orleans. I love ghost stories. I grew up reading Anne Rice. So for this New Year's resolution experiment, I was writing a paranormal story, and I knew that when the workshop ended, I wasn't going to have that accountability of, you know, showing up every week, doing the discussion groups, and I was really happy writing. So I joined this website called Wattpad. For those who haven't heard of it, it's kind of like Facebook for readers and writers, and I highly recommend it if you're either of those, which I suspect anyone listening to this program is. You know, it's kind of like any other social network platform where you have friends, and but there's an e-reader inside your profile. And I use this as my accountability mechanism. So we all get busy. The hardest part about writing is writing. So every Sunday I would post a chapter with no expectation for anyone to read it. Just I really wanted something to keep me more disciplined because I was worried that, you know, it would end up like all other New Year's resolutions. You know, you do it for a couple of months and then you stop and you wait until December to come up with a new one. So I wrote the first part of the book, so kind of act one. And if I hadn't been on Wattpad, I don't know if I really would have kept going because it was such an achievement for me at the time, being a new writer, that I could even write that much. I hadn't written that many words since college, but people started messaging me, you know, when are you going to post the next chapter? Are you going to write more? You're not stopping, you know, all these really encouraging messages. And it was enough to just be like, well, you know, these people want to know what's happening next. So I kept writing, and a few months later, I was sitting in Paris. I can remember very distinctly solving the mystery of the book because, of course, in newbie fashion, I had no outline, no anything. And I solved the mystery and was like, whoa, there's going to be an ending to this book. This is going to be in a whole manuscript. And it took a few more weeks, I suppose. That was around Thanksgiving. And when I posted the end of the story, kind of went viral online. And, you know, things have just gotten crazier ever since.
So you gave yourself a deadline. You created an audience. That's what every writer dreams of. And you wrote this while you had a demanding full-time job.
Yes. It did really change my life. I never knew I was a real morning person, but I started getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning and writing before I went to work. And it worked out. I guess that structure also helped me.
So in this novel, in The Romeo Catchers, you're getting the coven back together, and you still have your same wonderful protagonist, who is this lovely and powerful young woman named Adele, who's charting her course through the post-Katrina French Quarter. And I think the bottom of the cup tea room is one of your important landmarks. Am I right?
Yeah. So the bottom of the cup tea room gets a huge setting in the second book, and it's not in the first book. For anyone listening who doesn't know, it's the oldest psychic institution in the country, I think. It's in the French Quarter. It's been there since the 1920s. And when I was a little bit older than Adele, and I think this is the most direct experience that correlates, because everyone always asks me, you know, what part of Adele was based on you? And this is probably the most direct connection, but I worked also at the bottom of the cup tea room when I was a little bit older than Adele. And my mother actually worked there when she was younger as well. So I've always known the family my whole life, and it's just a very special place to me. So if anyone is into tarot or getting any kind of fortunes told, they pretty much do it all. If you've never been there, you should go. And it's an experience.
Well, those are some of the most atmospheric and wonderful parts of the book, I think. Oh, so one of the other things I love about your books is the way you dabble in history, both of New Orleans itself, and you always have some historical context for what's going on. And in The Romeo Catchers, that context is 17th century Florence. So what drew you to that?
Well, I love history, which is ironic because I spend a lot of my day with technology and trend forecasting and thinking about the future. But New Orleans, to me, has one of the most fascinating histories of anywhere in the world. And the whole series takes three specific urban legends in the French Quarter and twists them together. A couple more come in the second book. You know, my writing exercise and what I was thinking about so much, you know, was really the history of these urban legends and how did they come into the zeitgeist, you know, and where in history did they start the stories and how could they be connected to the present day? And I think part of it was an excuse just for me to be able to read a lot of history. But at the time when I was starting the story, I developed a fascination with the Ursuline nuns and their role in colonizing New Orleans, and just the role of being a nun in the 15th and 16th centuries in Europe. The urban legend of the Casket Girls, of course, takes place at the old Ursuline convent, so it was just a natural bridge there in the first book. And then I had such a good time writing that historical plot line, I wanted to do it again in the second book. And Florence served the story a bit better in the second novel, which is an amazing city as well.
You know, everybody who writes about vampires and witches in New Orleans writes in that long shadow of Anne Rice. And I wonder, how conscious were you of having to do something different?
It's a really good question, because I feel like, on one hand, I would say extremely aware. And not just Anne Rice, you know, the Twilights, the True Bloods, the Sookie Stackhouse novels, all of the super popular, you know, mainstream novels around vampires. And I think, to me, I didn't really even think about vampires that much. I was just thinking about monsters, you know, and this whole idea of the other, and thinking a lot about classic monster literature. Frankenstein, I think, was a huge inspiration, especially writing the letters in the book. And when I was younger, going to the Anne Rice Ball was like the epitome of cool, like what I wanted to do as a teenager. And it was really interesting as I wrote the book, because there was a real resentment and kind of negative sentiment towards anything to do with vampires coming off of the Twilight craze. So on one hand, I just did whatever I wanted, because I figured, like, everyone hates this anyway, so I don't need to worry about it too much. I'm just doing what I wanted to do. And I mean, even in the workshop I was taking, one of the constant points of conversation, which is how much people hated Stephanie Meyer, YA, vampires, all of these things. And it almost made me more interested in writing that stuff just because it was constantly in the discourse.
Now, you've readily set the scene for the third book. Are you deep into that one yet? Have you begun?
I have definitely begun. A lot of the book is outlined, kind of the exact opposite experience of the first book.
Oh, but see, you have an editor now.
Yeah, that helps. No, but when I was writing the second book, I had to do a lot of the legwork for the third book as well, so it could just be very anchored together. So I just started, I would say, actually writing it a couple of weeks ago. So I'm a few chapters in, but because it is the third book and it is the conclusion, you know, a lot more is known for me as the writer, which is exciting.
Well, that'll be fun for all of us. And one thing I love is that, you know, here you go, it's 600 plus pages. And it's a very satisfying escape, I have to say.
Yeah, I keep trying to make them shorter, and then it doesn't really happen.
We've been talking with Elise Arden, whose new novel, the sequel to The Casket Girls, is called The Romeo Catchers. You can meet her Tuesday, May 23rd from 6 to 8 at a book release party hosted by Boutique du Vampire at the Beauregard Kai's House. That's at 1113 Charters. Or again, Thursday, May 25th at 6 at Octavia Books. Elise, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I can't wait for the event.
Joshua Jolly Shapiro is a scholar, a geographer, and a writer whose work has appeared in many national publications. He's the co-editor with Rebecca Solnit of Nonstop Metropolis, a New York City atlas, and his work also appeared in Unfathomable City, a New Orleans atlas, which Rebecca Solnit edited with Rebecca Snedeker. He's a visiting scholar at New York University's Institute for Public Knowledge, and today we're talking about his book, Island People, the Caribbean and the World. Joshua Jolly Shapiro, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So here we are in the northernmost city of the Caribbean, which you have also written about so brilliantly.
Indeed. Well, I love to think of New Orleans as a Caribbean city. Being back here, I'm so struck walking around and I say, oh, this block looks like Havana. This block feels like Port of Spain. This is Kingston. So the city really feels and looks like a Caribbean place. But of course, that's deeply rooted in its history. It's a place that has been linked to the lands and peoples to its south in really essential ways for centuries.
And you refer to it so much in Island People. So tell us how a guy from Vermont fell in love with the Caribbean.
Yes. Well, I think the way in for me, as you say, I grew up in Vermont, which is not a very Caribbean place.
Not at all.
Long winters and all the rest. But the way in for me initially is, I think it may be for lots of people, is music. I fell in love with Jamaican music first when I was 12 or 13 years old. I had Bob Marley posters on the wall, and there was a great Vermont reggae festival, interestingly enough, where people from Jamaica came and performed. But then I got deeply into Cuban music, and then in college I studied Caribbean literature. I think I had a sense from quite early on that, of course, I was drawn to these things and these sounds in particular, but I felt that the Caribbean was a place where much of what we think about as unique or interesting about the Americas is thrown into really stark relief. You know, these histories of people coming from everywhere, histories of slavery, histories of genocide, some of these dark histories, but also this incredible cultural vibrancy that's about people figuring out how to be, how to live, how to create culture and history of their own in a new world place and on these beautiful islands.
And you talk a lot about how islands are the perfect laboratory for a social scientist, you know, because they're contained in that way. So I wonder if you'd describe a bit your island hopping life for the writing of this book and how it evolved over time, because it's a huge, comprehensive book.
Yes, no, absolutely. As I say, I mean, it very much began as a kind of memoir of affinity, you might call it, that I was, you know, so drawn to these places. I visited for the first time when I was 18 or so, went to Cuba, visited a couple times in college. I was researching these cultures and literatures. And then in graduate school, I was out in California, but I'd worked on a dissertation about the Caribbean and its central role in shaping modern world culture. And so I was visiting every chance I got. You know, that was very much about scraping together grant money and maxing out credit cards. And, you know, it's all a sort of struggle in a sense. But I just kept going every chance I got for over a decade, really. And when it came time to write this book, I'd done it first as a scholarly study, but I wanted to create a new portrait of the region that was really, you know, readable and vivid and alive. And my hope was to convey some of the wonder and magic of these places that many people think of as great to go on vacation, but they don't think deeply necessarily about the history and the culture and the vibrancy of Cuba, of Trinidad, of Jamaica, of Puerto Rico, of these wonderful places that I was driven to write about.
Well, there are so many differences from place to place that you point out, but so many factors bind this region together. Sugar is one thing, big sugar. Slavery is another. You write a lot about carnival and yes. the love of music. But you talk a lot, and this fascinates me, about how a country or an island forms an idea of itself. You write about Cubanidad, for example. You know, what is Cuban, you know?
One thing I was really interested to write about here was that when you read and study the Caribbean in a scholarly setting, there's a great body of literature that people talk about. The Caribbean is this, the Caribbean is that. Thinking about it as a region, and it's joined, as you say, by a shared history of the triangle trade, of sugar, of slavery. But I think that all of the islands also, especially the big ones, have a deep pride and sense of themselves as unique, as special. In Cuba, as you say, whatever one's politics, and of course there are deep divides politically in Cuba, or people who have left and gone to Miami, or people who stayed and supported Fidel Castro, right? But whatever their views, everyone's deeply proud of being Cuban and has this idea that Cubanness is something that's unique and special and has to do with music, has to do with rhythm, has to do with something about the built environment, has to do with identity, has to do with the ways in which people are in public. And I think that one thing that runs across the islands is that performing oneself as a character and thinking about being in this new world place where everyone's making it up as they go along. These are very performative cultures in a lot of ways, and that right. goes along with the carnival traditions in many of these places, which, of course, is a deep part of New Orleans as well.
Well, and also that sense of a common story, a shared story. I mean, I've often thought about how New Orleans, you know, everyone here is a citizen by choice since Katrina, and we have that narrative we share together. And that's true of these islands as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that when you're in Jamaica, you wouldn't hear someone say, I'm Caribbean. People say, I'm Jamaican.
Right.
You know, I'm very proud of being Jamaican, and we do things in this way, and we have this music that shaped the world, and we have this folk culture that we embrace and celebrate. But I think that that pride and that sense of being extroverted and of creating oneself as a character is really something that runs through the islands.
Oh, yeah. We all love to be characters in New Orleans, too. That's another one. Now, I do love the way you just cannot suppress that love of music. It just kind of yes. bubbles up from chapter to chapter. And I love that you describe the way music comes back to the Caribbean, that long description of the Beyoncé concert at the end of your book.
Right.
That was fascinating. I wonder if you talk a bit about that.
Absolutely. I mean, that was a particular scene where I was in Trinidad at carnival time. And Beyoncé came there to close her world tour in Trinidad, and everyone came out for it. And of course, at first glance, you think of, you know, she's this immense pop star and draws on different various traditions, hip hop and soul music and all these different things. But there's something about her act and many of the rhythms even involved in American pop and what she does and what hip hop is that are deeply Caribbean and that are deeply also about the look and feel of carnival in a lot of ways in Trinidad and elsewhere.
And more now than ever.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
People don't necessarily know it, but, you know, Justin Bieber's doing soca songs, essentially, you know.
Uh-huh.
So these rhythms, and this story, though, goes way, way back to take even the example of hip-hop music, which is still really the dominant strain of youth culture around the world. Hip-hop music, we know it comes from New York, it started in the Bronx, but who was really involved in its birth in the 1970s? You're talking about Jamaican kids and Puerto Rican kids and drawing on DJ culture in Jamaica and different things. So the ways in which the Caribbean really has suffused music everywhere, of course, we can talk about salsa as well, which is
yes.
Cuban rhythms. And the Caribbean has been this incredible kind of megaphone sometimes in ways that are credited and sometimes that aren't, that the particular mix of people and the particular ways in which rhythms and music from Africa in particular, you know, evolved and came together in the Caribbean has really shaped world culture.
Now, there are great characters all the way through this book. There are historical characters, historians themselves, your love of C.L.R. James, you know, and following his work, and people like Bob Marley, Usain Bolt, Chris Blackwell of Island Records, such a powerhouse, and so many writers. That's what I loved, of course, because this is the reading life, you know.
Yes.
But Ian Fleming, Derek Walcott, Jamaica Kincaid, Jean Rhys. So you give this broad sense of the cultural output in the larger world as well. But I want you to talk about some of those writers and what they meant to you.
Once I sort of moved on from the music, though the music never went away, the first thing I really studied in depth in an academic setting was the writing literature of the Caribbean. And there was really this extraordinary generation, I think, in particular, that emerged in the 1950s and 60s on the English-speaking islands. People like George Lamming, amazing writer from Barbados, and Wilson Harris from Guyana, Derek Walcott from St. Lucia, Jean Rhys from the island of Dominica. She's an incredible writer, an amazing stylist. And I think that, of course, there had been a writing of the Caribbean, a literature of the West Indies going back much further. But as the islands gained their independence and a sense of themselves, there was this flourishing, right, of literature from the islands. And I think that one thing that's incredibly rich about that writing is that it gives voice to the quest of all people, but that a quest that I think is particularly poignant in the Caribbean, to figure out exactly what we are. What is our identity? What is our culture? We've been a colony, but our ancestors came from Africa or elsewhere. What is it that we are? What do we have to say? Mm-hmm. And Derek Walcott, I love his speech after receiving the Nobel Prize. He said that the Caribbean, he liked to think of it as the islands being shards of a vase that had been shattered, but that when you put together the vase, it requires a kind of love and strength that is stronger than if it hadn't been broken apart, something to that effect. And I love that as a kind of metaphor for culture and for writing in the Caribbean. And there's incredible books that have emerged and continue to emerge. I think there's a great new boom going on, especially after Marlon James was awarded the Booker Prize a couple years ago. There's a great flourishing of interest. These writers have always been there, but there's a wonderful new, I think, emergence and attention being paid to the Caribbean and Caribbean writers, which is very exciting for me.
Now, you argue in this book that a lot of people often think of the Caribbean as marginalized, and you're arguing that it is central to world history. So one of the epigraphs from your book is from novelist Junot Diaz. We're all in the Caribbean, if you think about it. So talk a little bit about that.
Yes, absolutely. That epigraph, I think I was, you know, I was at a reading that I was doing in California years ago, and he just made that as an offhand remark. But I think that what he meant by it, and certainly what I try and explore in this book, are all the ways in which the Caribbean, as you say, we think of it as marginal, we think of it as a place to go on vacation. But in the story of world history and in the story of how the New World happened and how the Americas developed, the Caribbean was really the center of the triangle trade in a lot of ways. We think of the United States sometimes as maybe, oh, that was the center of slavery, because we know or are aware of the history of slavery here, of course. But the North America received something like 400,000 enslaved Africans over the course of the slave trade. The Caribbean received 6 million. And it was really, in a lot of ways, the central hub of people being brought from Africa, sugar being grown and brought to Europe. Of course, it's also where Columbus arrived first.
Yes.
So there is this sense that the Caribbean was where this huge engine of history got underway, which led to the emergence of capitalism, of modern politics, of any number of things, right? The Caribbean is really this site that world history and the history of the Atlantic world has moved through for centuries. And I think that the ways in which that has impacted the culture today are profound and need to be examined. And that's what I try and do in this book.
Well, it's a fun trip. So many people have called it a travel book, but it's so much more than that.
Well, thank you.
It's a deep, rich exploration. We've been talking with Joshua Jelly Shapiro, whose new book is Island People, the Caribbean and the World. Josh, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Hey, Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Nancy Sharon Collins presents Letters Read, Lafcadio Hearn, Tuesday, May 23rd at 6 at Crescent City Books. The evening features sociologist Dr. Adrienne McFall providing some context for Hearn's letters with readings by Ashton Ackridge and Richard Mayer. Alexandria Marzano-Lesnovich signs The Fact of a Body, A Murder, A Memoir, Tuesday, May 23rd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, Elise Arden, signs The Casket Girls and its sequel, The Romeo Catchers, Tuesday, May 23rd from 6 to 8 at a book release party hosted by Boutique de Vampire at the Beauregard Kai's House, 1113 Charters. Or meet Elise again Thursday, May 25th at 6 at Octavia Books. Kathy Schrenk signs A Dog Steals Home Wednesday, May 24th from 5 to 8 at Sippin' in the Courtyard at Maison Dupuis Hotel in conjunction with the Louisiana SPCA Offsite Adoption Event. Food writer John T. Edge appears in conversation with Brett Anderson, and afterwards, John signs his book, The Potlucker Papers, A Food History of the Modern South, Thursday, May 25th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. James Nolan discusses and signs Flight Risk, Memoirs of a New Orleans Bad Boy, Thursday, May 25th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Dorothea Benton Frank discusses and signs Same Beach Next Year, Friday, May 26th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Todd Michael St. Pierre signs copies of his newest children's book, Chicory and Rue, The Creole Mouse and the Cajun Mouse, Saturday, May 27th at 1 at Barnes & Noble Mandeville. Poet Gina Ferrara reads from and signs her new book, Fitting the Sixth Finger, Poems Inspired by Marc Chagall, Sunday, May 28th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. The Women's National Book Association of New Orleans is sponsoring a book circle facilitated by Freddie Evans discussing the sassy bookwomen of New Orleans. That's Tuesday, May 30th. Doors open at 6. The event begins at 6:30 at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, 1205 North Rampart. Free, but RSVP to WNBAofNOLA@gmail.com. New members are welcome. And coming up, the 2017 Symphony Book Fair comes up Friday, June 2nd through Sunday, June 4th at the UNO Lakefront Arena on Franklin Avenue. Hours are Friday from 9 to 8. There's an admission charge from 9 to 3, free after 3. Saturday from 9 to 8 and Sunday from 9 to 4. Also coming up, it's time to start thinking about summer reading for young readers in our area. The annual East Baton Rouge Parish Library summer reading programs begin Tuesday, May 30th. All locations of the library will have reading logs for each age group, children, teens, and adults. These logs will be available till the end of July. Check out ebrpl.com for schedules and information. Every branch library in the New Orleans Public Library System holds a kickoff event June 3rd for summer reading. Check your branch library schedule or neworleanspubliclibrary.org for the complete schedule of events and summer reading groups. Library Palooza, the grand kickoff for the 2017 Jefferson Parish Summer Reading Program, happens from 10 a.m. to 12:30 on Saturday, June 3rd. That's at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. And from 10 to 2 Saturday, June 3rd at the Jane O'Brien Chatelaine West Bank Regional Library in Harvey. And if you're interested in working on your writing this summer, the New Orleans Writers Workshop is offering courses in two summer sessions from June 5th to 30th and July 17th to August 11th. For complete course offerings, visit neworleanswriters.com. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org. Thanks for listening and keep reading.